Thank you, Marshal. It's a great pleasure for me at this time to introduce our guest speaker for the day. You're all familiar with his very distinguished career in broadcasting, in radio, in television, through straight news reporting, documentaries, covering important moments of history. What may not be quite so familiar to many of you is the fact that he had an early and close association with the field of education. He graduated from Washington State College some very, very few years ago as a Phi Beta Kappa. Immediately thereafter, he became president of the National Student Federation. And in this capacity, he visited a number of universities and colleges throughout the United States and also in Europe. And while in Europe, he arranged some very interesting debates between European students and American students. Following this period, Mr. Murrow joined the Institute for International Education, which I know a number of you are familiar with, which is instrumental in the exchange of student program. For the Institute, he was assistant director in charge of offices in London, in Paris, in Vienna, and also in Geneva, I believe. Through the program of the Institute, European students, of course, came to this country, and American students going to universities abroad moved through these offices in Europe. He has, for many years, been a member of the Board of Trustees of the Institute for International Education. In his present challenging job as director of the U.S. Information Agency, therefore, he must feel quite at home with the exchange of persons program with which the agency is very instrumental. As you know, U.S. Information Service posts in many countries of the world help to arrange exchange of visits between Europeans, European students, or Asian students, students from the Near East, teachers, professional people, labor leaders. And the Information Service posts help to smooth the path. He will talk to us for a little while today on the general subject of education in the world today. At the end of his talk, incidentally, he has said that he will welcome questions from the floor. We will have to limit it, I imagine, to 5 or 10 minutes. Marshall will designate the time when he feels we should leave. It gives me a great deal of pleasure then to introduce to you the director of the U.S. Information Agency, Mr. Edward R. Murrow. Mr. Murrow.
Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, I am delighted to have been present during your election proceedings. I shall, however, feel obliged to suppress this information from our clients abroad, lest they gain the impression that we are operating a guided democracy in this country. As has been revealed to you, I was once on the periphery of the academic world. Since then, I have become what Macaulay referred to as a smatterer. Others have contended that I have exchanged the role of poacher for that of gamekeeper in the area of news and information. As one who plied his trade in broadcast journalism, I feel a most natural affinity to members of the press. Now that we have dined and refined our appetites to the near vanishing point, there remains only this concluding act of inflicting upon your patient ears these few fumbling thoughts of a man in search of the cause of service. As press educators, you will perhaps share with me this savor of crisis in the education of a press minion. I am told that when an editor of eminence was beginning as a young reporter, he was sent to cover his first big story and returned to the city room to attack his typewriter with all the ferocity that is common to a young cub. Time passed. His city editor wandered over to see how he was getting on. He said, "How's it coming, son?" And the youngster said, "Fine. I'm already on page 14. And the old hand commented, "That's splendid, son, just splendid. Just keep right at it, and I suggest that when you insert the next sheet in the machine, you number it page 2. I shall take that maximum of a story as my own. For brevity is a quality oft desired in a bureaucrat and only occasionally abandoned." Memory recalls a burst of campaign oratory by William Jennings Bryan, who at a moment of peroration grasped the chairman's gavel and struck the podium a mighty blow. The head of the gavel flew off the handle and hit a spectator in the second row, who, as he slid from the chair to the floor, could be heard to murmur, "Hit me again, friend, I can still hear you talking." "I find you have disarmed me, Mr. Chairman. I have no gavel at hand. And the only thing I can afflict you with is to tell you something of my agency and how we are involved in education abroad in the world today. I find most people are largely ignorant about what the U.S. Information Agency does. That, of course, is understandable. Our product is invisible, our goals are intangible, and by congressional mandate, we operate from the shores of this country outward. Whatever we do is for export only, and generally we receive a domestic publicity only when we fall flat on our face, which upon occasion we do. We're engaged in that difficult task of telling America's story abroad. We seek to turn politics into understanding. What we endeavor is to reflect with fidelity to our allies, to uncommitted nations, and to ourselves, not only our policy, but our ideals. To accomplish this, we use all the media of communication: radio, television, motion pictures, newspapers, magazines, wireless files, books, pamphlets, cartoons, trade fairs, teaching, education, and the face-to-face conversation with ministers and members of foreign governments and societies. We must therefore speak in many languages to many peoples of vastly differing cultures. Our media must talk to peons and professors, to Asian illiterates and Israeli intellectuals, to Congolese natives, to Muslim shopkeepers, and to Indian Hindus, to the Filipino merchant and the Japanese scholar. This means we approach them in their own country, whatever its climate or terrain, in their own language, whatever its dialect or difficulty, in their level of comprehension, and whatever its depth. We must deal with the realities of their fears, their concerns, their stereotypes of the product we promote, the hopes and actions of the United States government. I shall not burden you with details of most of our operations. Our radio, the Voice of America, broadcasts up to 64 languages and is on the air 107 hours a day. More airtime, I might add, than the major commercial networks in this country combined. Our television services stations in 57 countries. Our motion pictures reach a monthly film audience of about 600 million people. Our wireless news file sends out some 10,000 words a day to each of 5 major world areas. We turn out 68 magazines in 28 languages. We print over 12 million pamphlets and some 25 newspapers, wall posters, and periodicals in 14 languages. We have in circulation 150 traveling exhibits. But you are interested in education, and education abroad is one of the areas that most concerns our 219 overseas posts in 99 foreign countries. The heart of our operations on the intellectual front abroad is, of course, our libraries. but to call them libraries is rather misleading. They do stock over 2.25 million volumes that reached about 26 million persons last year. That's a lot of circulation for books, magazines, newspapers, and other periodicals. But these locales of ours do much more than lend books. They can only be described by a catch-all phrase, a cultural center. They show documentary films, display exhibits, stage concerts and lectures, organize seminars and study groups, provide special activities for children and youth groups, place programs on local radio and television stations. A former Mexican foreign minister is reported to have said to an American diplomat, "The United States has done many fine things for Mexico. You spent $50 million helping us eradicate hoof and mouth disease. You constructed sewage systems in each of our towns along the border. You have helped us build health clinics and other public works throughout the country. But the finest single thing you have ever done for us, in my opinion, was the establishment of the Benjamin Franklin Library in Mexico City." One must agree with the foreign minister that our USIS libraries are one of the finest things we have done in many countries. We have 176 of them, along with 85 reading rooms, in 80 free world countries. It is perhaps a paradoxical comment upon our success that USIS centers and libraries are usually the first targets of rioting mobs and demonstrators. Our libraries have been pillaged in Bogota, Baghdad, Athens, Beirut, Algiers, Calcutta, Taipei, Cyprus, and to a lesser degree in a half dozen other places. Yet, often the rioters themselves return to use our facilities. Our attendance does not slacken after such demonstrations. Local citizenry quite often pitch in to help with the cleanup and repair. Once in Athens, the cadets in the Greek Naval Academy began a campaign to raise funds for repairs and even carried the campaign into the public schools. Attackers assail our libraries and information centers for many reasons. Some are nationalist outbursts, others communist fomented. But their very concentration upon our posts shows the enhanced position of the United States in world affairs and the potency of the ideas and ideals we have to offer. I find it equally interesting to note that when we have decided to close a library or a cultural center for budgetary or other reasons, local townspeople almost invariably petition us to keep it open. In Germany, some cities have even built new buildings and offered them free of charge to keep the libraries from closing. In lands with few cities but many people, we take our culture and books to the people. With mobile projectors, by riverboat, by jeep, and by donkey. In many countries, locally sponsored institutions are also serving in the cause of our country's culture. We call them binational centers. They are locally formed by the people of the area in cooperation with the United States and frequently with American citizens resident there. Their purpose is to promote the ties between the host country and the United States. Each center is indigenous, non-political, non-profit, non-sectarian. We supply services, top personnel, facilities, and books. But their very strength is in their local autonomy, their local roots, and their local participation. There are 128 of these binational centers today, many of them in Latin America. We participate quite heavily in the pioneering spade work of building education in lands emerging from illiteracy. These lands have an urgent desire to absorb as much as they can and to do it as fast as they can. Carbon copies of educational systems and practices in this country are of little avail, but our experience is of great use, and this we parcel out liberally for local people to adapt to their own needs. For example, we gave the Nepal Government College of Education a collection of 250 books on education to use both for present training and as models for developing texts for the Nepal schools. In Pakistan, the Ministry of Education is using a set of our textbooks to guide them in the writing of history texts for secondary schools in Pakistan. When I say our textbooks, I obviously do not mean that we in the U.S. Information Agency wrote or produced the textbooks. They are textbooks that are in use in this country. We also have had an active role in encouraging the establishment of American studies courses in overseas universities. In India, for example, by judicious placement of book presentations, American studies programs are underway at the universities in Calcutta, Bombay, New Delhi, and Madras. The trend is spreading to Japan and Brazil. Just as much of the world would share our knowledge and emulate our machine age productivity, so would they speak our language. Teaching the English tongue is high on our list of activities. Last year, over 250,000 people in 55 countries took instruction in English. We ran some 87 seminars for over 5,000 local teachers of English, who will in turn teach over 1,000,000 students. We are distributing currently a television series, Let's Learn English, now running on 34 stations in 20 countries. 7 other countries have requested the series. Its success augurs well for its expanded use abroad. I could attempt to amaze you with tales of the impact of English in foreign lands. There is a man in Latin America who rides all day and all night on horseback to get to his weekly English lesson, then returns home the same distance. In Africa, a group of chieftains was told that the English lessons would have to be postponed because there were no chairs in our new building. So they showed up anyway, each chief carrying his own chair. In Central America, a small boy, barely large enough to reach the counter, came in to pay tuition for his English lessons. And he asked rather shyly if it was all right for him to come barefoot. He was told yes, and it was only much later that we discovered he had sold his only pair of shoes to pay for his English lessons. In Mexico City, the announcement of English lessons drew such a crowd, a day in advance, that special police were brought out to stand guard all night. And the next morning, when the office opened, the first men through the door to register were the special police. 7,500 people a day are now studying English in our center in Mexico City alone. In Africa, we number among our English pupils several prime ministers, plus cabinet ministers and high officials, too numerous to catalog. In one country, we even laid on English lessons for the entire cabinet at the special request of the country's chief executive. Paralleling this interest in speaking in our tongue is the passion for reading of our knowledge. And so we promote the publication of books, 6,000,000 of them published overseas last year in English and in other languages. By assisting foreign publishers and encouraging translations of American books, the average output has been around 6,000,000 books a year over the last decade, and this in about 50 languages. We last year also distributed some 3.5 million books and magazines contributed through voluntary collections in this country. And we have specialty programs as well, low-price paperback editions that sell for the equivalent of 10 or 15 cents, special editions of books for those with limited English facility, done in vocabularies of 1, 2, or 3,000 words. One of the more encouraging aspects of our book program is the use of our textbooks in foreign educational systems. Burma, Indonesia, India, Israel, Pakistan, Poland, Yugoslavia, and the United Arab Republic are all training part of their youth on educational texts obtained through this country. And there is another aspect of this unremitting war we wage for the wits of men. On the publishing front, we are outgunned by the competition. Last year alone, Russian books distributed to non-communist countries rose by 30% to a high total of 40 million. That is 40 million books published in non-communist bloc languages. It will come as no surprise when I add that the greatest increase came in the underdeveloped countries. Furthermore, The Communists added 7 new languages last year, all of them South Asian or African. It is obvious, of course, that what they peddle is not ideas but ideology. There is not near so much Tolstoy, Dostoevsky, and Turgenev as there is Marx, Engels, and Lenin. And it is equally well to note that my figure of 40 million was for books produced in Russia alone. There is at least twice this amount of communist publishing done outside the USSR and Red China. It was inevitable, I suppose, that any discussion of USIA's educational role abroad would drift onto the shoals of the present great political confrontation. It would be trite to say that we live in what could be a watershed of history. If this nation could have its druthers, some might counsel a wish to live in a time of crisis less burdensome than the present. It is far less strained to read of the stormy fortunes of nationhood in history books than it is to live through them in anxiety. For my own part, I would, I think, choose no other time than now. Peril there is, and in full abundance. But there is opportunity as well, and challenge, and hope. And these too are with us in great abundance. It would be misleading of me to describe our fate as other than one of great struggle. We are in combat, but combat of a different order. That the sound of shot and powder is only rarely in our ears does not make it less a struggle. If anything, it increases the mortality of danger. Everyone knows to resist when attacked. But our decisions today are not easy ones, like resistance to invasion. There is threat abroad, but its danger is more indirect and for that reason more insidious. And if this is our fate, then victory, of course, is our goal. But as our combat is of different order, so must be our victory. We, as a nation, are accustomed to clearly drawn lines and quickly gained triumphs. But the victory we seek will not be so easily recognized. It may not even come in our lifetime. It may fall to our heirs to finish these tasks. This victory will see no ticker tape parades up Broadway. There will be no bands, no extras on the newsstand, no climactic battles, no holidays proclaimed, no burst of enthusiasm on that suddenly arrived date. It will be a victory which will take years, perhaps decades of hard work. And each year will be composed of months of anxiety. It will take the combined efforts of many to achieve it. It will not be a victory of the United States over the Soviet Union. It will not be, I suggest, a victory of capitalism over socialism. It will be a victory of revolutions realized, but revolution without violence. It will be the victory of men and nations standing straight and standing for their individuality as nations. It will be the victory of hope over despair, of accomplishment over frustration, of action over apathy. It will be the victory of freedom in the world as men have the right to know and to demand it. We believe this victory will come, and on both sides of the Iron Curtain. To believe any less is to be untrue to ourselves. And in a forum of educators, what man would dare suggest untruth as his premise? But truth, like the proverbial night, has 1,000 eyes. Many will view this truth with jaundiced eye and querulous gaze. We must try to see our truth in right perspective and to know that in the fullness of time, we marshal that truth and our power in the better service of all mankind.
On behalf of all those attending, I thank you, Mr. Murrow, for giving us this insight not only into the problems of your organization, but into the drama of world events today. We're quite thankful to you. And now, I think we should take a few minutes, if you don't mind, for some questions or comments from the floor. No questions, a comment, any reactions? They're too stunned. Yes, sir.
Rectified and belatedly, I might add. This is one of the shortcomings, not only in Latin America, but quite honestly in Africa as well. In our libraries in the French-speaking parts of Africa, we have too many books in English and not enough in French. This is something that the publishers and the Congress willing, we will put right. He would give us the rights immediately, I'm sure.
On this question of books, Mr. Murrow, when you said we send 6 million books, yes. You mean copies, don't you? You don't mean different.
No, 6 million total print run. This could well be a misleading figure, because this includes only the books that we publish or subsidize abroad. This does not include the great outpouring of books that go abroad through normal commercial channels. And this illustrates one point in regard to this agency that we should all bear in mind, and that is the sum total of communication between this country and the rest of the world, only about this much of the spectrum is represented by the U.S. Information Agency. We do produce films and television, but their impact is infinitesimal compared to the impact of the Hollywood output and the television programs that are sent abroad by the networks and the syndicators and so forth. There are 30,000 missionaries, for example, abroad, spending about four times our total budget in the course of a given year. So we have no monopoly, fortunately, on the export of information from this country. Yes.
It doesn't require too complex an answer. How are books selected? You said abroad.
We have, when we open a new library, a standard catalog, so to speak, in translation. From there on, the books are ordered mainly by our posts abroad, by the librarians, who can develop some measure of the appetite that is required to be satisfied.
Yeah. You mentioned the barefoot Mexican boy and his tuition charges for English lessons. Would you care to say a few words as to why there is a need for tuition charges and how the finances are handled?
This occurred in connection with a binational center, and each one operates with a great degree of independence. Some of them charge a small tuition fee for English lessons in order to meet their overhead. Some do not. But this is a local option operation.
For our education, there have been reports that you will be running for the Senate this coming year. Do you care to comment?
Uh, I have spent a great deal of time reporting the doings of politicians. I am convinced that to run for elective office requires a special temperament and a special appetite. I have neither. Therefore, the answer to the question is no. No, we are not doing anything to foster a common world language except insofar as we are promoting the study and teaching of English.
I think, Mr. Murrow, this is a good chance to cut off. Thank you. Thank you again very much. This brings to an end our luncheon and our final one for this year. We thank you so much. Goodbye.